Ground is down.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 206.LV2733, certificate number 48966. Change of gauge.
You're fairly well traveled. Wouldn't you say? I mean, you and your family like to go on vacations.
Yes.
Plus, you're a great adventurer who's pioneered many routes across the Gobi.
I did discover Victoria Falls in the 1890s. I mean, discovered. Obviously, we all know
the local tribes
had called it Loudwater, Majestic Water, or
They'd
whatever.
Known it for many centuries.
But I was the one who was like, Majestic Water, that name sucks. You know who's cool? Queen Victoria. She wears black. She's not that into sex.
As far as we know.
She misses her husband, but so maybe she was into sex?
I mean, if you think about the fact that one of the most prominent genital piercings is named after her husband. And by prominent, I mean both largely adopted and also fairly prominent.
Prominent to the naked eye.
Yeah, that's right.
I do enjoy traveling. I'm trying not to commit myself because what is this innate of? Like, what am I about to get nailed down into?
Well, I mean, you've seen other parts of the world.
I've seen things.
You know, you've seen the sea beams glitter off the shoulder of Orion.
Yeah, Tannhauser Gate, check. Mm-hmm. Got that on my bucket list.
But when you were young, you lived in Korea. Then you're fluent in Spanish, so you've traveled in Central America.
Some, yeah.
A little bit of South America, am I right?
Yeah, but it's pretty much American middle class. It's not really adventure travel.
Right.
Like, we went to Costa Rica, but we didn't go to Honduras. Because you know why? Like, 900 people get murdered every year in Honduras.
900 people?
I don't know. It's like the world's highest per capita murder rate.
Is that right?
And Costa Rica, right across the border, is quite nice.
Yeah. Why bother going over there? It's the same climate, probably.
The ceviche is probably equally good, but you're going to get murdered after.
Yeah.
I think I'm modestly well-traveled. I have friends that are always like, here's what we're going to do, the Trans-Siberian Railroad.
Right. Introduce me to your friends. They seem more interesting than you.
They are more interesting than me. Well, not on a podcast.
Wait a minute,
maybe.
I'm your friends.
When you're actually interesting, you don't have to try to look interesting at parties by saying, hey, you know what? Kazakhstan.
Hey, you're absolutely right. That's why I've stopped saying Kazakhstan at parties, except when I'm trying to activate my Manchurian candidates.
Is that the thing?
Kazakhstan.
Why don't we pass the time with a nice game of Kazakhstan? It's a solitaire variant played in Uzbekistan.
I think one of the interesting things is that you married fairly young.
Yeah, she was 14.
And so...
you mean I was young.
In the style of the time. So you and your wife have been co-adventurers. You never went really through a phase where, except when you were on a mission, you weren't like out on your own, lonely man.
Sure. Two years of Spain, I guess. And a childhood knocking around Seoul, right. Korea, trying not to get run over by motorcycles. But you're right.
But we've talked on the Omnibus about rail travel a couple of times, and in my case, you know, my dramatic younger life, in your case, the choo-choo trains of Thomas the Tank Engine.
Right. Yeah, you did. Well, you did the MIT Model Railroad show. So you have probably done the nerdiest train show.
You're right.
Like Thomas the Tank Engine is toxic masculinity compared to the MIT Tech Railroad Club.
How do you feel about the romance of the rails? Does it call to you? Do you feel the lure of train travel?
I do. I love train travel, but maybe not so much Depression era hobo freight riding.
Sure, I understand.
That seems like what if camping, but worse.
It's more rustic.
It certainly is.
There's no bar car.
I feel like you're using this as a recommendation. And I'm saying exactly. It's more rustic. But I prefer like the Hitchcockian idea of a railroad as a ticket to glamour and adventure.
Sure.
And who knows who you will meet in the lounge car, and maybe there's an assassin in the next compartment.
That's right. The Orient Express is the peak of that.
What I want is 12 people on the train from my past who all want to kill me. What are the odds?
Have you ever taken a train across America?
No. I feel like as a very little kid, I took an Amtrak train, but it was probably
from Bellingham to Everett.
It wasn't Sounder. But it was probably something like, I mean, I've taken the little commuter train here, which is fun because it's right along the Sound.
Yeah.
But I feel like I maybe did Salt Lake, Seattle. Was that ever doable by Amtrak in my lifetime?
Salt Lake to Seattle.
Maybe it's not.
You know, that would involve some switching around. There's a Salt Lake to San Francisco train, and there's a, I mean, you could do it. You maybe just have was, to get off.
Maybe
along
it
the
was
way.
Salt Lake to San Francisco. I don't know. I do have a memory of a exciting multi-state train trip, but it's, yeah, you know, the cratering of airline ticket prices kind of ended it for me, because if you're going to get somewhere, do you want to get there in an hour and a half or 3 days?
Well, it depends. I mean, if you got nowhere to be and nobody's waiting for you at the other end.
If you got people in the next car waiting to kill you,
take all the time you have, you want.
You don't want to let them down.
I've been a proponent of reintroducing lighter than air travel.
Yes, you want
dirigibles and blimps.
Balloons?
Balloon travel. You know, when I was growing up, I think we talked about this on the show, in Anchorage, there was a really vital ballooning community. It was an affectation of the nouveau riche at the time.
To own your own hot air balloon?
To own a hot air balloon. It really was. Like, if you
does it have your net worth on the
you had a cool rainbow. A lot of them are rainbow colored. Yeah. But all through the 70s and 80s, on a calm day, summer and winter, the skies over Anchorage were filled with hot air balloons.
I feel like hot air balloon iconography was kind of at its peak then. It's Lisa Frank kind of a vibe of day glow colors.
Yeah.
I feel like as a kid, I was always coloring in hot air balloons in a coloring book or something.
Well, and in Salt Lake, you know, Salt Lake there against the mountains, it's kind of famous for kiting and
hang gliding for sure,
but maybe hot air ballooning not so much.
I think there's hot air ballooning maybe up in Park City or something. We do it here. Have you ever seen them kind of going up and down over Woodinville out east?
Well, yeah, but it's just it's a shadow of its former self and the hot air ballooning world. And I think in Anchorage there was a definite like a law passed, a moment in time where it went from. Sometimes you'd look up, there'd be 25 hot air balloons in the sky, and then one day there were none.
Was there a cop in a hot air balloon, like beckoning to traffic? And
I think it was
like an intersection.
I think that's the thing about hot air balloons—you can't really steer them.
Everybody goes the exact same direction. There's no collisions, right? Because everybody moves with the wind.
Right.
This has little or nothing to do with change of gauge. But I last night at dinner, we were discussing the possibility of hot air ballooning.
What?
Sometime this summer.
This came up. Just last night?
Yes.
Wow. Omnibus, once again.
I mean, by the time anybody listens to this, it's already happened, but we're going to go to Montana this summer, pandemic permitting. Mm-hmm. And
well, there's nothing more socially distant than being up in a hot air balloon.
In a big sky.
Right.
It's right there in the name. You're in big sky country. The sky's big. And the kids were very afraid. The kids did not want to be in a precarious balloon. And I said, from what I hear, it's the opposite of stressful because you're moving with, have you ever been in a hot air balloon? Mm-hmm. So you move with the wind, right? So there's no air movement. It's eerily calm, right? Mm-hmm. And is it scary? Does that make it less scary or more scary?
The thing that is scary to the gentle soul is that in order to get the balloon up there, you have to hit this butane burner and it's extremely loud and like a very forceful burn of gas. So it's like, and also you see this huge flame above your head. And if you're in the, I'm just in the total peaceful quiet of the sky. And then this burner goes off. It's a real transition.
What
emotionally?
If, what if you're into it for ASMR reasons?
I mean, I'm super into it. That's one of the sounds of my childhood, you know, sitting around and listening to the hot air balloons.
calling to each other like across the, like across the cicadas. Bay. maybe that's why the eerie calm. Like they subject you to this awful eardrum cracking noise and then they're like, they turn it off. Yeah. And you're like, wow, it is quiet now that you amazing. Turned off that giant burner, doofus.
Yeah, it's a, it, that's right. The enjoyment of a hot air balloon is 80% Stockholm syndrome.
you hope the balloon men will let you go.
You totally defend them in any argument later. You're like, they're great. They're amazing.
Are there usually confrontations with your balloon men after you land? Like a farmer with a pitchfork? I've told you before to stay out of my field.
Yeah, you usually come down into some kind of tar pit and
really?
Yeah, and half the people are entombed.
And you're like, hey, buddy, this is Balloon Man Barry. I want you to step back.
Step off. Balloon Man Barry is here.
Why are we talking about balloons?
Oh, just because of the romance of
sure.
balloons and the romance of lighter than air travel and the lighter than air travel as an alternative to rail travel. Which is an alternative to air travel.
I guess it would be an alternative to rail. The speeds would not rival the jet age, but you could travel in this meditative style.
In the sense of me wanting to be a dirigible impresario or a Zeppelin well, sure. impresario, imagine the, first well, of all.
List the concrete steps you have taken to become a Zeppelin impresario.
I mentioned it on podcasts.
If you don't work for it, it's not a goal, John. It's a wish.
I'm still gathering steam. I'm gathering investors.
You don't need steam.
That's right. You don't need steam.
You need helium.
Not steam powered. Although steampunk.
You could be a steampunk Zeppelin impresario.
I really want. I have the mustache, or could. No, I think the Orient Expressification of the dirigible gondola is
East Asia Express.
I mean, you cannot. Put any limit on the amount of lux.
Sure.
I mean, it would put the SS United States to shame.
You just would expect fountains and gold fittings.
Chocolate fountains. And then you could have everyone who ever wanted you dead. And no, you couldn't even get off at the station. They're all on there. There's no escape.
Is there an Agatha Christie Zeppelin murder? I think maybe there's not.
No.
What a missed opportunity.
Well, if you don't work toward it, Ken, it's just a wish.
I guess that's true. If I'm not trying to bring Agatha Christie back from the dead with some kind of revival electrical powers.
No, I'm saying
and forcing her to write a book set on a Zeppelin.
You're the author. You stop writing books about paperclips and start, you know, be novelizing.
Be the change you want to see in the world.
When you lived in Spain, surely you traveled by rail.
Yes, high-speed rail in Europe is such a joy. And not just in Spain. I've traveled through Central and Western Europe through it's the way to go.
Largely on high-speed rail or on your regular rail?
Regular rail in Spain and France. I've done some high-speed rail. Regular rail in Central Europe. High-speed rail through Spain and France and Korea in the past. And Japan. It's great.
Yeah, high-speed rail is great. And it's fortunate for you that you took high-speed rail between Spain and France. Because the alternative, taking regular trains from Spain to France, is pretty complicated.
Well, I have a story here.
Oh, let's hear it.
So you can travel high-speed rail easily within France and within Spain, but at the time we were traveling between Paris and Barcelona by train, I don't know if it was an option. Can you do it high-speed? Can you do high-speed rail today?
Now you can.
I don't know if it was an option when we did it. And so I looked up an itinerary between Paris and Barcelona and bought a ticket to Montpellier, which I guess when I printed it out, I thought maybe Montpellier was the name of some kind of Catalan train station.
Right.
And it turns out what I had bought was the first leg of my journey to Barcelona, but I was, 100 miles north of the French border, because as you say, the gauge changes, right, between France and the railroad gauge. So you have to get off a train and get on a different train that will be on a different rail system that will actually get you to Barcelona.
Yes.
So I got to enjoy a cafe in Montpellier for 3 hours waiting for my differently sized train to finish my journey.
The legend is that when the rail systems in Europe were being constructed, it was not that long after France had invaded Spain for the last time, hopefully.
For the last time yet.
And so as the French and Spanish were building rail networks, the Spanish intentionally made the gauge of their track a wider gauge than the French lines in order to inhibit the French ability to just run trains straight, as part of an invasion scheme.
I like how there's some kind of Mediterranean macho to making it a little wider too. Like we have a wide stance.
That's right.
We have a wide stance here in Spain.
But what that has meant is from the very beginning of rail travel in Europe, the transition between France and Spain, I mean, there's always been rail traffic between the two and commerce traveling between the two, and it is always a problem at the border until the advent of high-speed rail where
somebody laid new track?
Or you're
just going so fast it doesn't matter.
you just the wheels skip across. No, high-speed rail is a more contemporary evolution, and when high-speed rail was being designed, you had to build a new system.
Hey,
you couldn't just put them on standard
track. Hey, guys,
this
time, let's make sure it doesn't suck.
Right. So they standardized a gauge, and now you can travel via Renfe and TGV, and it kind of have an uninterrupted travel. And in fact, the high-speed rail in Spain that I kind of watched that being built over the years because I traveled to Spain quite a bit, and it was that was a major, major infrastructural project that took a really long time just to build high-speed rail from Madrid to Barcelona. Watching it go in and all of the, it was kind of for a while there, it seemed like the Basque separatists were always planting bombs under it the Catalonian separatists also kind of threatening the high-speed rail. It's one of the scariest things about high-speed rail.
Is the Basques might blow it up. Even if you're going like Tokyo to Hokkaido, you're like, I hope there's no Basques.
That's why we don't have it here in America, because the threat of the Basques is
they might come over from Idaho and push down one of those crazy plungers like the explosive happy Muppet.
or Snidely Whiplash.
Exactly,
right?
Snidely Whiplash.
Might tie a maiden to the track.
I'm sure. Let's make somebody feel happy. I'm going to admit right now, I cannot remember the name of the Muppet that pushes down on the plunger and blows stuff up. So if you know that, you should feel very smug right now.
Who is it? It's not another Muppet that is also the plunger Muppet, or is there a specific plunger
It's kind of
Muppet?
His main gag is that I think it's Elmo, actually.
Elmo.
Yeah, when I was I worked for a few months in like La Mancha, kind of in the middle of nowhere when I was a Mormon missionary in Spain. And that was kind of the one place where you
were
could
you the
go.
Man of?
I was the man. Yeah, okay. I was El Hombre de La Mancha. And that was kind of the one place, missionaries do not live a Lux Zeppelin chocolate fountain lifestyle.
Sadly.
So we were always traveling in steerage. We were in, shipped in crates. And that was the one trip where you were allowed to take the Ave, the high speed, the high-speed Renfe train, and it felt very fancy after living in squalor for 2 years. it's not that fancy, by the way, by the standards of, you don't get like the fun little bentos you get on Japanese bullet trains.
Those fast trains, did you find looking out the window difficult sometimes? It was it moving fast enough that it made you dizzy or sick to your stomach?
No, I don't get sick on trains. I can even sit backwards. I'm a superhero, basically. Yeah. But it does feel very space age. You're like, how am I going this speed at ground level? Because, you know, stuff in the distance will be moving at a nice normal speed. And then something will happen close enough to make you realize you're going 200 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And you'll be like, whoa!
The high-speed rail actually uses something approximating standard gauge. And standard gauge even is a... I won't say misnomer, but there's standard gauge and then there's standard gauge.
You're going to have to explain this all to me from the ground up. Gauge is the width of train tracks, the distance between the two rails.
Well, there are issues beyond just the distance between the tracks. And one of the primary ones is, it's a standard called loading gauge, and loading gauge is the way of measuring not just the distance between the tracks, but how much weight the tracks can bear, how wide a diameter the actual train cars can be in order to make it under bridges and through tunnels.
I see.
So you can have standard gauge trains where the tracks look exactly the same, but a train from one country could not possibly make it through just the infrastructure of another country. Not to mention that some trains, particularly if you're talking about electrical or electrified rail, all the differences in electrical systems, the differences between couplers and brake systems, pneumatic brakes.
Let me ask you probably the stupidest question you're going to hear.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, you ready for this stupid question?
Yeah, let me hear it.
What is the name of the Muppet? No, I'm just kidding. What can a train car adjust? Are any of them adjustable so that their wheels can be moved to go on different gauge tracks, or is a car of a gauge and that's all you get?
This is not a dumb question. Oh. This is a question that has been almost since the advent of rail, a question that has kind of needed a solution, because from the very beginning, there was not a standardization of what train gauges, you know, from the outset, there was competition.
I feel like from the outset, they should have picked a number.
They should have. But the original trains, England was the first place to really build a train network. But like everything sort of powered by capitalism, it was also powered by competition. And most of the initial trains that went in were private enterprises, yeah, and they went from one place to another. Trains didn't start out being built as networks. They were built as a line from hither to thither.
So you got VHS and Beta.
Right.
Every time you go to a different city, it's a different company, and they've internally decided their own gauge.
Here's an idea. Why don't we build a train? Well, how far apart should the tracks be? Well, let's put them this far apart.
And it'll just be based on their internal considerations, not like what would be a good nationwide standard.
Initially, no. Right. You know, it's like from my elbow to my ankle seems reasonable.
And it's just some guy pacing it off.
And the reason, you know, and the a narrower gauge enables you to do it enables you to have a lot more flexibility in the sense that a narrower gauge,
what does that mean?
A smaller distance between the tracks.
So tighter corners?
Tighter corners.
It's probably cheaper to build too. You have to, the gravel bed, all the infrastructure that goes into laying track, it's less work. It's less square acreage.
In every respect, right? The tunnels that you have to bore, yeah, bridges over the tracks, all of it is much easier the smaller the train.
So why not just make it small?
The problem is smaller train does not have the loading capacity. A smaller train can't go as fast. Smaller trains just don't, they're not as practical if you're going from London to Brighton.
They look kind of goofy.
Yeah.
It looks like one of those backyard train sets where like Walt Disney is sitting on the roof of the engine. Cause it's a weird mini train.
Sure. Why not? You know, why not build a funicular if you're going to build a little narrow gauge, nothing.
Is it still a funicular if it's horizontal?
Well, the thing is the tracks are horizontal, but the cars are all tilted. No,
that's not fun. That's just an icular.
One of the first big, you know, train networks was the Great Northern Railway in the UK.
Yeah.
And that was designed by a man, who's, I think, widely regarded as one of the greatest engineers of all time, and in fact, one of the greatest Britons of all time, a man named Isambard Kingdom Brunel.
Oh, right. I.K. Brunel.
Yeah. Isambard Kingdom Brunel.
Are we pulling down his statues for anything? Did he also run a slave ship or anything?
Isambard got into the civil engineering game after the whole slave ship era.
Yay.
And in fact, he
was still extremely racist. However,
I do not, in my limited research of Isambard in terms of trying to figure out his contribution to rail gauges, I did not find any reason to cancel him. And I'm not sure whether or not Omnibus is really the engine of cancellation for baddies.
For bad engineers of the 19th century.
I feel like we're talking to futurelings who don't even see color.
They've already canceled us for 6 things we said on this show.
Because futurelings are seeing in infrared, so they have a whole different picture of what human beings look like.
Were there a ton of people named Isambard back then? Doesn't Saruman live in Isambard?
Isambard was named after his dad, whose first name was Mark. So Mark got off easy.
Honey, should we name him Mark or Isambard?
But Isambard, I think his father was born in France, and you know, Isambard's a family name. If you go back far enough, everybody's got a name like de Tocqueville in their history. I'm sure you what's the earliest person in your lineage that you can put a name to?
Oh, like right now without having to look it up?
Have you looked into?
Yeah, I think I've got genealogical lines going back to medieval England.
Yeah, right. But you don't know anybody's name because some of them are great.
Yeah.
Barzilla is a name that keeps popping up
in my family.
Barzilla.
Barzilla?
Yeah.
Is Barzilla it's like a Welsh monster that takes out Tokyo?
There goes Tokyo. Go, go, Barzilla.
Back to Isambard.
Yeah. So Isambard, he was raised, his father was an engineer, and he sat at his father's right hand as Mark Brunel built the first tunnel under the Thames, the first rail tunnel, the first... this is the dawn of the age of massive engineering projects, and Mark Brunel was an engineer of the first rank. So much so that although he was clearly bad at money, he was sent to debtor's prison at one point, and the British government, because debtor's prison was very fashionable at the time, he had no way to repay the £5,000 he owed. And the British government showed no sign of releasing him from debtor's prison until he figured it out. And so he threatened them. He threatened them by saying that he was going to go work for the Tsar building rail.
You could always scare people with Russians.
and the British government was like, oh, whoa, 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 whoa. We don't want you to go work for the Tsar. We'll pay your debts. And they somehow ponied up £5,000 to get him out of jail.
But at what point did Mark Brunel become the quarterback for the Jacksonville Jaguars? Was that later?
That's a little bit of transubstantiation where he became the body and the blood of
He was later reincarnated.
Okay, so Isambard, as his son, kind of was raised in these big engineering projects. In fact, he, as a young man, almost was killed in a flooding of the Trans Thames rail tunnel.
Don't tell your mother.
But he, Isambard, was instrumental in, he built the first steel-hulled propeller-driven ship.
Ooh.
But also was the chief engineer of the Great Western Railway. And in his big plot for the world, his gauge for the Great Western Railway was 7 foot across. And if you think about standard gauge is 4'8.5".
Is that true to this day? Yeah. Like a lot of American railroads are still 4'8"?
4'8" is if you could say there was a global standard, which there isn't anywhere, but 4'8" is a widely adopted what's known as standard gauge. It's what the Renfro and TGV high-speed rail in Europe use.
Because you want to be able to tie a woman to the tracks.
Right, four foot eight.
And 4 foot seven would be a very short woman indeed.
You could, like,
you could tie Linda Hunt to the tracks.
The thing is, you can tie her to one track.
You can tie her to one track. It's just as fatal. Let's be honest.
You don't have to run faster than the bear. You just have to run faster than your friend. And at the time, 4 foot eight was considered narrow gauge rail. And there was his attempt to standardize rail gauge at 7 feet was kind of unrealistic. He was building a major rail line that was his idea was that it would, you know, go between major cities.
Bigger is better. Is that
bigger
the idea?
Is better. Hmm. There were a lot of other, I mean, dozens of other rail companies in the UK that were using gauges that they had just made up. A lot of them really small. The smallest gauge of rail that is practical or even, I guess, like useful is only 15 inches.
15 inches?
Tiny,
it's like an ice skate.
It's you know, little rail cars that you see in mines.
Yeah.
The Guinness Brewery actually had a rail line within the brewery that was very narrow and had locomotives and everything.
It's little, whatever the Oompa Loompas of beer are.
Yeah, little cute little rail lines. And then the
leprechauns, probably. That's what the Oompa Loompas of Guinness beer are.
The little leprechauns of Guinness.
That make Guinness.
And then the Great Northern Railway, this giant,
I feel like width is not what you, I mean, I don't want to, I'm not trying to size shame anyone. I know girth is important, but I feel like if you're trying to wow people with the size of your, the prominence of your railroad.
You want it to be taller?
Yes. How tall is the engine? This engine is 38 feet tall. It's like the smokestacks are like a wedding cake.
But you can imagine the stability of a train with a 7 foot wheelbase.
Is this a time when people are maybe worried about trains? So the width of the track conveys a lot of safety?
No, I think he's imagining, he's probably just imagining like load and also the comfort of. If you've ever traveled on a transcontinental train,
like a wide body jet, yeah.
you can hardly put a bed wide enough for a human person inside an Amtrak. But if it was 7 feet wide, holy cow! You could, because you know, then the train the compartment can sit up above it and be 15 feet wide.
Is that true? The compartments can be much wider than the gauge of the wheels,
depending on
the tunnels and stuff.
Yeah, depending on the other gauge that we were just discussing.
Right.
Or the other gauges, the loading gauges of the train. If you look at a British underground train, you know, a tube, in those locations where the tube comes out of the ground and in its course of becoming kind of a local railway that goes out to the suburbs.
Yeah. Happens in West London a lot.
You can see that the loading gauge of the train is such a tight mirroring of right. Of the tunnel, right? There's 3 inches of tolerance.
If you go in whatever those whatever the oldest lines are, where you can really see that the car, every car is a cylinder.
Yeah.
And if you stand too close to the door, you had better not be tall because you realize when it goes into the tunnel, it's because it's going through it's like a Play-Doh extruding thing. It's going into a hole exactly the size of that cylinder.
Right. Right. And that makes it very hard for the London Underground. I mean, there are multiple different loading gauges within the London Underground. There are cars in certain sections of the underground that can't go into other sections.
Yeah.
And all of that is routed. And there are all kinds of sort of measurement gauges, like to ensure that a train isn't misrouted.
Because if you did, you know, if you were the guy standing by the door and you go into the wrong tunnel,
kawack,
you just lost the top of your head.
Crazily, this is also true of the subways of Manhattan.
Huh.
The trains from the old BMT, the Brooklyn Manhattan Transit, and the trains of the Interborough Rapid Transit, the IRT, cannot mutually interchange. The gauge of the tunnels and all this other systems.
It's like two species that can't interbreed.
And you don't think of that when you're in Manhattan. When you're in London, you just get on a train and off you go.
Well, in subways generally, the trains are going back and forth. You know, you wouldn't expect one of these trains from the Metropolitan line to suddenly be able to switch to the Piccadilly line. It's a non-issue. But if you're, I guess if you're running the whole system and ordering the trains, it's got to be a nightmare today that you've got all these historical relics.
Well, and I think you just keep, you keep the two systems discrete.
Yeah.
In answer to your question earlier about whether or not there are trains with multiple gauges, capable of multiple gauges.
This speaks to my soul. Can I become a different kind of person, or am I locked into my gauge forever?
There are a lot of different ways to accomplish this, and many of them were pioneered during what were called the gauge wars in the UK in the mid-1800s, partly in response to this Great Western Railway 7-foot gauge. There was a recognition as the train network expanded to include more and more of the UK. At a certain point, it was clear to everybody, we can't have 15 different gauges. We can't be like the Germans and have 42 different governments. We have to have some sort of standard. But there was a lot of, it was VHS and Beta. There was a lot of impetus on the part of any one particular company to have their gauge become the standard, because it's extremely expensive to migrate your rolling stock to a new.
It's got
to
be the worst migration ever. You're essentially, all of your infrastructure is now wrong, and every inch of it has to change by the exact same amount.
So tons of different ways of solving this problem were devised, and one of them is to have sort of multiple gauge tracks. All you need is one track, let's say on the left, that's going to be your left track. And then to the right, depending on how wide the various gauges are, you could have two or three tracks over there, and just each one kind of representing a wider gauge. That becomes a switching issue. Right. As trains enter your system, you've got to have a pretty complicated way of connecting to other rail. There were the idea of having the bogey or the truck, which is where that's the kind of system of wheels that sit underneath a car.
I see. It's like the chassis of a train car.
Yeah, and those are separate from the car. Mm-hmm. In a lot of cases, the idea that you would roll a train up and pull the old bogies off and put new bogies on in order to have the bogies represent the new gauge was a system, and is and continues to be a system.
That seems awful. Like the stuff stays loaded, the freight car or whatever stays loaded, but you have to switch out the thing it's sitting on.
Right.
And while it's on track,
I've gone through this process. The way that they do it between France and Spain is actually they have bogies that can change gauge. So they bring the train in. You're on the train. They bring it into a shop, and there's a machine that they unlock the bogies. They unlock the axles from themselves. The machine pushes the wheels out to the Iberian gauge.
They're not swapping in a new bogey. They are just widening.
They're just widening the bogey as it is, and then they lock it down. But I have a very distinct memory of traveling in Belgium in the 80s and having bogies actually swapped out. I'm not sure if that's a false memory or not.
Well, you know what they say. If you have a distinct memory of traveling through Belgium in the 80s, you weren't actually there.
Right. It was a UFO or a UFO probing encounter.
It's an implanted memory. We'll make him think Belgian railroads are super weird.
But there are lots of instances in the world where the train is brought in, the bogies are lowered out in a kind of, into a bay, and moved aside, and new smaller or larger gauge bogies are brought in and put up.
Is something holding the car itself from the side? It's wedged in or something?
Yeah, the car is held in a clamped. Kind of crane or clamped there. And in some places you can make a transition. You can basically switch a train without anyone getting off or any freight moving, switch it to a completely new gauge, and off it goes in a matter of an hour.
Yeah, when we were in Montpellier, I wonder if we just got back on the same train that had been re-gauged, or if if we just got onto a different train on a different line.
Probably a different train on a different line. If they make you get off, it's much easier to just put you on a different train.
I assume that's what happened.
Transferring like goods and people from one train to another, it's a lot easier to do with people.
The people will get up and walk.
It's super hard to do with
the coal or whatever will not.
Right. And also, you know, any kind of freight.
Except cows. They can walk.
Cows can walk, but you know, is that what you really want to, you want to get a shepherd boy out there to move cows from one train to the next? This idea of transshipment, which is, you know, taking everything out of one car and moving it to another, really expensive. It also increases your rate of breakage by, you know, some nth power. And it was this problem, and it started as a gauge problem and a transshipment problem, was kind of the birth of the idea of containerized freight. Containerized freight didn't really become an international standard until the 50s and later. It's been an ongoing process. But the idea occurred to people in the 1850s, just as a way of like, well, what if we just made the box the thing, and we moved the box from one set of bogies to another? That's a more substantially difficult problem in 1850.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to lift off the box,
right?
And back then, really, that's not an option. So, who won the gauge wars? Were there also? Why isn't this episode called the Gauge Wars? That seems pretty good.
Well, the Gauge Wars is a pretty good episode title, but
for people who have made it this far, you guys know that's the secret title of this entry.
The Gauge Wars were kind of, you know, a UK competition phenomenon as it expanded out to the idea of global train networks connecting with one another. It did continue to be kind of a war, like a soft war, but one where a nation has, in the development of its rail system, a nation has a lot more initially interest in having the gauge of rails within its own country be compatible, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
because most of the goods you're initially shipping with rail are international.
Especially at this intranational,
yeah. Sorry.
Especially at the time these systems were being created. I mean,
right.
Today, if you were building one from the ground up, you would think about travel or, you know, trade with your neighbors.
Right now, what you want to do is get as many television sets as you can from Shanghai to wherever you are. But at the time, generally what you're doing is bringing coal down, you're shipping trees around, you're taking stuff from the plant to the
turnips,
neighboring town.
In the case of Britain, a lot of turnips.
A lot of turnips. In Ukraine, it was all, it was borscht, huge
are they,
tanker cars.
They're tanker cars.
Borscht. Cabbages.
All the hobos would sit on top of the car and just dip in with a ladle. Every hobo would have a ladle coming out of his pocket or her pocket.
But now it has become a global issue. Because rail travel is global, and a lot of the solution to containerization, particularly between European countries and countries in Asia, is like, well, why don't we put the train on a boat and we'll take the boat to, you know, it'll be a ferry, a train ferry that goes from Finland to Russia. But oh, wait a minute, the gauge of track is different in Russia too. So what we have to do is take the train onto the ferry, but also
change the train.
Change
wheels.
The train, right? There are other ways of having trains that I didn't mention of switching gauges, including in various places around the world where they will have a separate train flat car with the gauge, the narrower gauge, and they'll actually ride the other train up on the differently gauged flat car.
I guess it probably only works if you're going to a wider one, right?
Right. Or going to you can go to a narrower one,
huh?
Because your old bogies just kind of straddle this new.
Oh, it hangs over the edge.
Yeah, this new, like, much narrower car. This is a problem in Hokkaido, where as they were building the super fast rail, they had They had, it wasn't a question of train gauge, like width of track or width of bogey as much as it was the speed tolerances, because really hot, fast trains could go through these tunnels in Hokkaido at 200 miles an hour, but they had to share the tunnels with freight trains that were only rated at 100 miles an hour.
It's like a routing problem too.
And so what they did, what they're working on right now is a system, and it's not even built yet, is a system called train on train, where they're putting, train on train action, where they're putting freight trains on these higher speed, like train carrying trains.
So the freight train gets a momentary turbo boost through the tunnel.
So the freight trains can hot rod through the tunnels just to keep the system moving faster. That's their solution, rather than to go through the, what would be an incredible process of turning freight trains into high speed rail. Almost unfathomable investment.
It is amazing that you can take these high speed trains between the Japanese islands, because those are long tunnels. But
some of the longest.
Right? I think in the world. And I think at this point, I don't think you can take the high speed rail, the bullet train, all the way to Sapporo. If I remember when we did, and I think this is still true, they're building it, but you have to get off the Shinkansen at Hakodate, which is like the little city at the southernmost point of Hokkaido, and then switch to local regular speed rail that actually gets you into the city.
One of the countries that has the sort of the worst intra gauge problems is the great nation of Australia. As Australia was railifying, the different states of Australia were kind of deciding what gauge to build their rails, and this was happening in that era of the gauge wars in the UK.
This is going to be hilarious if every state winds up with its own gauge, since, you know, those Australian states have like what, 70 people tops.
Yeah, well, and it was New South Wales that really pulled a switcheroo on everybody, because New South Wales, in the process of kind of deciding what standard gauge was going to be in Australia, New South Wales said, we're going to go with the Irish gauge, 5'3" rail gauge, and that's going to be our standard.
More like New South Ireland.
And so the states around them, South Australia, Victoria, chose 5'3", and then New South Wales reneged on the deal and switched themselves over to standard gauge. But by that point, South Australia and Victoria were pot committed to 5'3", and so went ahead with it. And then Queensland and Western Australia,
which could not be further apart, by the way,
threw just their caution to the wind, and both use 3'6" gauge, which is also the gauge of rail in New Zealand.
That seems like a little toy train. That's very...
Western Australia, it's not like they have long distances to cover. Why not have a little three foot six inch gauge choo-choos? So Australia, to this day, has a lot of gauge, intra-national gauge issues, and a lot of kind of technological fixes to get goods and services and passenger trains moving from place to place.
But in the U.S., that is not true. We standardized our freight rail earlier than that.
Well, in the U.S., there were a lot of narrow gauge railways that were mostly specific to mining,
sure, mines,
and mountain trains, privately owned trains that served, you know, Gunnison, Colorado, or various places. And as time went on, as those train systems were integrated into the larger network, we standardized most rail in the U.S. There still are narrow gauge railways here, but they don't connect.
Yeah.
They're, you know, dinner trains and sort of tourist trains. Not very many mining railways left in the U.S. Compared to 100 years ago. So we do use, you know, standard gauge. And another problem is that railroads were invented or first popularized in the UK, which, of course, used imperial measurement.
I was going to ask.
But now rail
is... 7'2" or whatever is pretty arbitrary if you're in using centimeters.
And the sort of the millimeter gauge of railroads that are used globally, it's very complicated to make an exact sort of
it turns out analog. To be, 32.689 centimeters or something.
Yeah, like the main line in Spain. Mainline railway, which is the wider gauge, the Iberian gauge, is 1668 millimeters, which translates to 5'5" 21/32".
I was wondering how far you'd have to drill down to actually get the tolerances right on train wheels. I mean, apparently you have to be within a 32nd of an inch, or that sucker is not going to roll.
Well, you don't. It's funny because a lot of these gauges can work with one another.
How much give?
Like Finland uses 1524 millimeter gauge railway, which is 5 feet. Russia uses 1520 millimeters, four millimeters smaller, which translates to 4'11" 22/32".
It's half a centimeter. It's a quarter of an inch.
Right. Something. And these railways they work with each other.
Really?
Uh-huh.
The wheel just hits a tiny bit over on the rail.
In Spain and Portugal, the difference between the two Iberian systems is a distance of about 8 millimeters. So Spain uses 1672, Portugal uses 1664, and the new Iberian system.
There's a new Iberian system?
Is 1668, so kind of splitting the difference. And all of these trains can share track.
You know, if a train car can be flexible, John, to get along better, why can't we?
I know. Why can't I be just 8 millimeters different than I am?
Meet me in the middle here.
What's crazy is that the Iberian rail gauge is closest to the rail gauge used in India.
that probably helps a lot.
Which is 1676, which, of course, those two rail systems do not interconnect at all, India and Spain.
I would not expect them to.
But surplus rolling stock from both are usable in Argentina and Chile.
You could get on the Darjeeling Limited in Tierra del Fuego.
Right, and end up... Well, you'd end up in British Honduras, where you might be one of the 900 people that are killed.
You'll be quickly murdered.
So that's a really interesting kind of global situation where there is a huge market for used trains, right? It's as a developing country expands their capacity, they're going to want to buy the cool used trains from Spain if they can just work out their gauges. And in present day world, the main sort of promoter of international freight rail is China. China is...
Because it does all the car manufacturing, or...?
They're very invested, because China is a planned economy and a sort of top-down... a top-down economy, yeah. Right? If somebody in the Chinese Politburo decides that they're going to focus on backyard blast furnaces, that becomes Chinese policy. And people in Chinese government are really fixated on rail, kind of to the consternation of the global freight moving set, because transferring containers by ship is so much more efficient than by rail that the global transshippers are just baffled that anyone would use a train if they could use a ship.
Even if the ship has to go the long way around, it's still likely to be cheaper.
So as China increases China has pursued a policy called the New Silk Road, or the One Belt, One Road system.
The one gauge policy.
Where they are trying to build a rail network that goes all the way from, you know, southern China to northern Europe. And they're integrating part of the Trans-Siberian Railway. They're trying to connect with all these existing mm-hmm. railways in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and Iran, but they're also trying to go, you know, there's a brand new tunnel built under the Bosphorus in wow. Turkey, a brand new rail tunnel that's just recently opened. But the Chinese have to navigate.
It might be the first tunnel between continents. It just occurs to me. Do you think that's the first train tunnel between two continents?
It could
be, huh?
I mean, yeah, I guess England's not a continent and neither is Sweden.
I've always, you know, I will go to my grave insisting that Sweden is not a continent. I have the T-shirt.
You know what? I've been to the continent of Sweden and I take great umbrage at what you're... Let me think about that. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, unless there's other Istanbul tunnels that are already there. I don't know.
There are bridges.
Or Suez. Yeah, maybe it's all bridges though.
But this new tunnel under the Bosphorus is kind of like one of, you could say there's always a new final link mm-hmm. in this chain. One of the major problems, though, is the number of different gauges that they have to navigate between Shanghai and, you know, Bremen.
Amsterdam. The train's got to literally, you know, it's got to be a transformer. It's got to be like every time it crosses a national boundary.
And it's really complicated because a lot of those places like Uzbekistan, you've got maybe a government that for a long time isn't interested in making it easy for you to ship goods and services across. They feel like they are you got to go across here, so they're going to
hold you up.
Yeah, we're going to hold you up. We're going to tax you. China has invested in building. China's amazing at building infrastructure, and they are right now building rail all over Africa. And it isn't clear where the profit is going to come from. This giant Silk Road of rail travel from China to Europe, they're sort of projecting that once it's really up and running, once they've really got it cooking, it's capable of moving 100,000 containers a year.
How about passengers? Wouldn't you love to go from...
So don't even get me started. What I want to do is I want to hook my Orient Express, like super luxe...
You've got some Wild Wild West train car on the caboose
on the back of this thing? Behind this, you know, this super greasy container shipping
full of uranium.
Train. The thing is that 100,000 containers is... like basically the port of Shanghai processes 100,000 containers a day coming in and out via ship. And so this rail network that China's investing billions into building to move 100,000 containers a year makes no financial sense if you're talking about moving rail from, or if you're talking about moving freight from Shanghai to Hamburg.
I've always assumed that these Chinese projects in Africa, and possibly this holds for Central Asia as well, are more about building a new geopolitical bloc than they are about turning a quick buck.
That's 100% true. And all the different gauges, all the work that China is putting in to make one world, there's never been really a reason to sink the rail gauge of Romania to the rail gauge of Uzbekistan.
Yeah, I don't care at all about that.
And weirdly, I mean, even in Europe, the rail gauge of Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, and Romania, and the rail gauge of Russia, Lithuania, Belarus, Ukraine, and Moldova don't interact at all. And these are nations that border
it's
one
like
another.
The four-color map problem. Like, really how is. Many different gauges can you use to color Eastern Europe?
But for China to be the one that finally, like, either standardizes gauges or permanently solves the problem of how to move a single train across multiple gauges across the world efficiently is more about global political strategizing.
It's hegemony. It's like, we're the ones who did it. Like, right. You're all basically Chinese vassal states now.
And they may be playing five-dimensional chess, but there's
five-dimensional shogi.
But there's a lot of five-dimensional go. But there's a lot of hubbub in the global hoi polloi about what China's endgame is in building this international, like, the new gauge war, the new Silk Road, the One Belt, One Road.
Well, our listeners know what happened. They know what China's plan was, so they're laughing at us right now. Once China activated the tracks and, I don't know.
Right, all of a sudden.
Shrunk them all and knocked off all the foreign rolling stock off their tracks or whatever.
Everybody else's train stops dead because China figured out a way to send, I don't know what, engine killing pulses through their the secret metallurgy of their new tracks.
And it's important to note here one thing, I think. I looked it up. The name of the Mad Bomber Muppet is Crazy Harry. And that concludes Change of Gauge, entry 206.LV2733, certificate number 48966 in the omnibus. Listeners, we speak to you from a past era where China is still consolidating its rail gauge power before the gauge-related catastrophe that eventually destroys us. We're so backwards here, we still have Facebook.
Mm.
It's just a place where you can go to read what Franklin Graham and Ben Shapiro think. It's very important.
Mm.
It's really good for old people to hear weird things about race science.
Somebody yelled at me the other day that I'm still on Instagram, and I was like, find someone else to yell at. I don't, you know, I'm living in the now.
You're not Mr. Instagram cheerleader.
No, I don't care about it. I'm just there because I don't even know why. I don't even know why, Ken. Why are you there?
I'm not there.
No, but why are you on the internet even?
I don't know.
What do you get out of it anymore?
Somebody who was mean to me once got canceled last night. That was fun.
Yeah.
That's always good.
Who, what, that weird actor that, or comedian? In quotes.
It'll be months in the past by the time everybody hears. But yes, one of the many pedophile comedians that zinged me once.
Oh, why did he zing you? What was the zing?
Tell me the zing. It's
Was it a good one? Did he get you?
No. It's too detailed to go into here.
It was dumb. He didn't get you.
But also it was like 3 years after the fact.
He found an old tweet?
He found an old tweet where I mentioned him and like got me good. And I was like, well, I guess I'll reply in 2022.
I've never heard of this guy. That's increasingly a problem for me. Like every day I turn on the internet and I'm like, who? What? Why would I care? Why do I care about this thing?
Filter by YouTuber.
But this is the thing about you, Ken. Do you ever feel like anybody really gets you? Like zings you good?
I thought you meant, does anybody really get you, like understand you? No, and I'm like, absolutely not.
But does anybody, do you ever feel like because you're pretty quick on the retort.
Yeah, but it hurts my feelings. Even if my comeback is better, that doesn't solve the sting of somebody being mean, a stranger being mean to me. And they're not even that mean. They're just like, you're Mr. dumb.
Smart guy.
You're dumb.
Yeah, but
shut up, Ken.
But does anybody ever really get you, though? Like, like not just hurt your feelings, but actually where you're like
where admire the craft of it?
Yeah, where you're like, you're just kind of a smoking pile of
Maybe
ash.
I would like that better. I would probably like that better. Please zing me more on Twitter. I'm at Ken Jennings.
Yeah.
John is at John Rag. Do not zing him. He's
No. If you can get a zing, this is the problem, right? I think about it and I'm like, oh, people like put me down all the time, but where's the one that where I'm like, oh, I'm done. I'm flamed.
Here's the thing.
Hardly ever happens.
If you're a dummy, don't roast us on Twitter.
Right.
But if you're not, I don't know, take a shot.
Here's the thing about dummies. They don't know they're dummies.
Dunning-Kruger effect. If you think you're a dummy, you're probably smart. Try zinging us.
Hey, there you go.
If you think you're smart, you're probably a dummy.
Leave us alone.
Twitter is guarded by two talking heads. One always says dumb things and one always says smart things. What one question can you ask either head?
They're both named Isambard.
If you, you were also at Omnibus Project on all these godforsaken places, you can find communities of like-minded Omnibus listeners, futurelings, we call them.
All of them very smart. All of them sentient rail cars.
At Speaking of sentient rail cars, by the way, when I told my wife we did had done a Thomas the Tank Engine show, she said, did you mention, and she mentioned all these Thomas the Tank Engine quotes that we had heard umpteen times when my son was little. And I, it was like a Proustian Madeleine. I had not thought about these things. She said, did you mention confusion and delay? And I said, no, that's right. They're always talking about confusion and delay.
Confusion and delay.
That's like the dystopia on the island of Sodor.
Right, the worst thing that could possibly happen.
I guess we did this whole episode about Gage Wars was about confusion and delay.
Confusion and delay is all that it produces.
Well, so we've done a second show about confusion and delay. Mindy will be happy. I don't know why I'm talking about that.
This is for you, Mindy. thank you for listening. Like all of our shows, this is for you.
We're like Casey Kasem now. We dedicate episode 206.LV2733. You can find your fellow futurelings on Facebook. Mm-hmm. On there's probably a Discord. There's a, what else is there? There's a subreddit. There's a sub Discord. There's maybe a sub subreddit. There's a sub sub basement to Reddit. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can send us physical items if you wish. These guys came a couple weeks ago, and I totally forgot about these, John. Our friend Brian sent us fivers.
Huh?
His grandfather was in the Navy in the 1930s, and as a result, I guess he has a collection of Asian monies with the number 5 on them. This is a newer one. This is a Chinese 5 yuan bill.
Hmm.
Look at the gauge of their money. What if they try to standardize us on this little monopoly-sized money?
I mean, it's got to be cheaper to produce, and it can get through smaller tunnels.
That's the thing about it. The slot on the ATM is so much smaller. You save money that way. We also have the Japanese government issuing 5 centavos. Can you figure this out? Why the Japanese government was printing 5 centavo bills?
Is this old or new?
Old.
I mean, there was a Japanese guy that was the president of Ecuador? Whoa.
Oh, Fujimori in Peru?
Peru, right.
I don't think that he would outsource his country's mint to Tokyo.
Why in the 1930s
were the Japanese printing 5 centavo bills? Oh,
because they were invading the Philippines.
Ding, ding, ding. Yes, this is occupation money from the Philippines. That's cool. You should take these.
Yeah, that's cool.
And this is... Oh, no, I'm sorry. That was the... Oh, this is an old 5 yuan bill. This was 5 wujiao. This is the new RMB currency. This is actually 1941, like Sun Yat-sen era Chinese money.
Whoa.
So thank you for sending us 5 of these things.
That's wonderful.
This letter comes from Alex.
Wait a minute. There's a $10 American in there.
Yes. Alex, this is twice as good. He sent us Alexander Hamilton.
That's real money.
It is real money.
And why are you putting it in your pocket?
I'm not. I'm taking it out of my pocket to see if I have a 5.
Oh.
We can split it right here live on the show.
Well, is that what you're being asked to do? What is the 10 about?
Ooh, Ken, I recently elected you as my person to be stranded on a desert island with.
Oh, boy.
John, you're on deck if Ken is otherwise indisposed. Your survival skills sound impressive. Oh, shoot. He says he included a stamp so we could send him a reply, but I don't know if we may have lost the stamp.
Hmm.
This may have to be your reply, unless I find the stamp, Alex. What would you like to say to him if you were going to write him a little note?
Well, I just want to know, like, if we're on a desert island, like, is this a chaste relationship or a smooching relationship? And if it's a smooching one, then I'm going to have a further list of questions.
Well, John wants to kiss you or maybe wants more than $5 for kissing you.
Yeah. So what, but why the $10? The letter goes on.
To support our incredible podcast.
Oh,
we often tell people don't send cash, but I mean, apparently they do. And then I immediately pocket it.
Send that cash.
A more efficient way to support the show. I mean, this is like this guy basically just put a $10 train car on a track from Shanghai to Bremen to Hamburg. But there's container ships now. The container ship of Patreon. You could support the show with a monthly donation at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Mm-hmm.
And we really appreciate that support. And we love doing the little perks and bonus content that our supporters receive, including a monthly addenda show at the end of each month. Let's see. I did the mail. I did the Patreon. That might be everything. I think I'm good. I'm out.
Ken's out. Peace. Mic drop. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, when our rail systems were shoddily, if at all, connected, and there were no other transcontinental tunnels, unlike your future world where the L.A. to Tokyo tunnel...
Every combination of continents has a tunnel, so it's 7 factorial, whatever that is. 210 times 3, 620, is it maybe 1240? 1,240 tunnels. There's an Australia to Europe... There's a South America to Africa.
That'd be so awesome.
There's an Antarctica to North America.
We should talk about this on the omnibus, but the project to build trains that run in vacuum tunnels.
Isn't this the Elon Musk thing?
Well, Elon is just piggybacking on ideas that have been bandied about for decades. The idea of an LA to New York vacuum tunnel, where the train is a maglev train, runs on... You know, it levitates.
But it takes almost no power because there's no air resistance.
There's no air resistance. And a train can go from, I don't know, I'm not going to speculate because there's an actual figure. Because
you'd be making it up.
But a train can go from L.A. to New York extremely fast.
A child can push it and it will get there in an hour.
Off it goes. But
you have to keep a straw, a vacuum straw, a crazy straw between New York and L.A., and I have no idea if that's cost effective.
The thing is, all the Basques have to do is...
They don't even need to blow anything up. No, they could just make a little hole in it.
They just make a little hole, right. So you would have to build this tunnel either like way up in the air or way underground in order to keep people from being able to disrupt it. And, I mean, way up in the air. How hard is it to dislodge a tunnel by a millimeter?
How tall is a Basque? Are we going to get in trouble? From Basques.
Oh, because of our anti-Basque comedy?
We're just joking. We know you guys are just Idaho goat farmers. You're lovely. Yeah. Your tapas are delicious, or pinchos, as you call them. Yeah. We know you're not blowing stuff up anymore.
No. And
you were a lot, but now less.
You've made eastern Idaho, you've made eastern Oregon, western Idaho inhabitable where no one else could. But also, I'm from the 1980s when you were a much more prominent source of
You were in more headlines.
You were, yeah. You were, well, it was back when you were training with the Libyans and the IRA and the Red Brigade and the Bader-Meinhof gang. And, you know, pick your friends better, Basques.
We're talking to newer, cooler Basques who are not ETA adjacent.
Anyway, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We, Ken and I, may not survive much longer after this episode is released and the Basques blow up our underground bunker. We hope and pray that catastrophe we fear may never come. Almost certainly, we're talking to futurelings that are 120% Basque. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.